Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio station, still on the air because of support from listeners like you. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I will be your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. True to our name, we have a variety of offerings for you this morning. But today also marks the end of Black History Month. To close out our show, Sharon Grant will be reflecting on the commercialization of Black History Month, and Julian Ankeny will be talking with Tabiti Lewis about the historic Black Arts Movement of Chicago. Before that, Jan Hocken and her guest psychologist Emmeline Friedman will be taking a look at a very different documentary, The Social Dilemma, about the manipulative forces behind social media. To start off our variety show, we have Bill Resnick speaking with Richard Lockman, professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Albany and author of the article, How Climate Change Will Affect Socialist Strategy. They discuss two key struggles for climate activists. The first is to defeat the fossil fuel industry by cutting off the investments and public subsidies that keep them going. The second goal is to strengthen the forces of local, public, democratically run renewable energy systems, which means defeating efforts by the investor-owned utilities like PGE and Pacific Power to kill the expansion of these public systems.
Hi, Richard Lockman. Welcome to KBOO.
Good to be with you, Bill.
Richard Lockman teaches sociology at the University of Albany and the State University of New York. He's an activist in the Sunrise Movement, works also with the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA. He's the author of First Class Passengers on a Sinking Ship, Elite Politics and the Decline of Great Powers. He's also written a great deal on strategy to stop climate change, including how to defeat the fossil fuel industry, also how climate change will affect socialist strategy and sustainable jobs and a sustainable environment through a Green New Deal that's in a forthcoming book. These articles are really good and useful in discussing the necessary struggles that have to be waged by climate action forces to maintain a livable, habitable planet. So, Richard Lockman, let's begin with the effort to stop the fossil fuel industry and its extraction and its transport by either rail or pipeline, also to stop its refining and its shipping, and to show that it is a dying industry and a very risky investment. Tell us the story.
Well, the weak point for the fossil fuel industry is that they have to transport the oil, coal, and natural gas, and the most efficient and cheapest way to do that is with huge pipelines. And those pipelines travel through government lands, through private lands, and through native reservations. And each of these provide opportunities to file court suits, conduct sit-ins, and all of these can slow down and recently in a number of cases stop these pipelines. And what's most heartening is that two completed pipelines, the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota and the Tesoro High Plains Pipeline, also in North Dakota, have been stopped. And these are completed pipelines. And as a result, in the case of Dakota Access, a court case, in the case of the Tesoro one, action by the Bureau of Indian Affairs that found that the pipeline trespassed on native lands, these pipelines have been shut down. What that means is for capitalist investors, these sorts of projects are highly risky. They can go through the whole process, get permits approved, have it built, and then the pipeline can't operate and their investment gets wiped out. And so these sorts of actions are leading banks and other sorts of investors to decide that fossil fuels is not a good place to put money. And of course, if they don't invest in it, the industry will come to a halt. There won't be new pipelines, and there won't be drilling.
The divestment movement that especially Bill McKibben has been pushing has also had some effect on investment in the fossil fuel industry. Is the divestment movement still operating fairly successfully?
Still operating, and everything helps. You can make an industry look disreputable so that various prominent capitalists or university endowments and religious endowments won't invest in these industries, will reduce the willingness of other people to invest in it, you know, either because it looks like an immoral industry. We saw that happen to some degree with tobacco or investments in South Africa during the apartheid era. That's helpful, but in the end, I think the most effective tactic is to make these sorts of investments unreliable. And so sit-ins in North Dakota, court suits have been the most effective, because there's nothing that scares off investors more than the thought that they can put money in and they'll never get it back. Biden, the minute he came in, signed an executive order revoking the permit for the Dakota Access Pipeline.
That was a surprise, wasn't it? I mean, people expected Biden to play corporate and talk about clean energy. The support is another enormous warning to investors to stop putting money into fossil fuels.
Yeah, it's a result of all the efforts during this campaign to put climate change at the center, and many people mobilized on this. And so while Biden didn't make any specific promise on Dakota Access, he said that he thought climate change was a major issue, and this is a way that he could express that. Certainly, you know, his short record as president-elect and president is not entirely positive. One of the key aides he appointed is a former congressman named Cedric Richmond. He was from Louisiana. Not so surprisingly, he was a big supporter of fossil fuels and got massive campaign contributions from the fossil fuel industry. We can't take for granted that Biden's going to do the right thing on every issue, but now appears he's going to do the right thing on more and more because he's under pressure from people who've mobilized.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Richard Lachman, who teaches sociology at the University of Albany, State University of New York. He writes he's active in building the Democratic Socialists of America and in the climate action movement, including the Sunrise. We've just discussed how our struggles to stop the fossil fuel industry has put those fine men and women and profiteers on the defense. In the second half of this interview, we'll discuss the struggles over the coming energy system based in renewable, mostly sun and wind energy. Richard Lachman, tell us about that struggle. It's between, of course, the investor-owned utilities on the one side who want to control the power and profits of their industry as it exists now. Electricity is going to become more important in our future. And community energy forces, those advocating, like folks at this radio station, including myself.
The goal is to have electricity produced entirely by renewable sources, you know, mainly solar and wind. And there are basically two ways to do that. One is to build giant windmills and giant solar farms, which will require massive investments, and for the for-profit utilities either to build and own these themselves or to enter into business arrangements with other capitalists who will set this up. And that's the style of business that these huge utilities are used to and that they're moving ahead on, and they're getting help in accomplishing that through government regulation and, to some extent, government subsidies. You know, there's talk of making a so-called smart grid a central piece of a multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure bill that President Biden is planning to propose in the spring. The other way to do that is to have it be much more decentralized. to have individuals or community groups put solar panels up on buildings and community sites, to build smaller windmills and to create local networks of distributing the electricity from that. And the utilities don't like that because it would cut them out. You know, it's a non-capitalist way of doing it. Nobody's going to profit from that. And so the utilities and other investors are going to try to resist that. There are also some wonderful things about renewable energy. You know, one of them beyond that it can save our planet is, in fact, it's more efficient if it's done in a decentralized way. If you're just looking at this in terms of efficiency and not thinking about the harms of capitalism or the environment, it's just cheaper and easier to do this on a local basis. That argument for having decentralized renewable energy on our side, in addition to the arguments of fairness and justice.
Yeah, and it also doesn't need the big grid. It needs confederation, it needs cooperation and storage regionally and with adjacent areas. It needs some coordination at the national level. But one thing it doesn't need is some vast, you pointed out, multi-trillion dollar grid that is in fact very unreliable. One of my favorite lines is the big grid is just as reliable as its most vulnerable pylon, and it also starts fires, as in California. It's very unreliable and not resilient. The big utilities just need those to maintain their centralized systems. They really can't operate on a local basis. The Biden administration, it seems to me, with Al Gore at the lead, maybe, and Kerry, Al Gore, he's changed his tune. He now talks about community energy as well. But they talk about, as you call, the so-called smart grid. You're expecting the Biden administration to support building of a smart grid?
Yeah, I think they're definitely going to do that. And if they were here, I think their response to us would be, we need to do everything, that we have to get away from fossil fuels as quickly as possible, and it won't be feasible to create enough community-based green energy fast enough to prevent catastrophic global warming. And at the same time as we're building community green energy, we're also going to have to give money to the big utilities and let them build a smart grid and encourage investors to construct gigantic solar farms and windmills. It's not an irrational argument. That you can see, you know, the appeal of it. And, you know, my guess is it's probably going to win the day, but that doesn't mean we should give up. We should be pushing as well for community-based green energy. And if we can construct enough of that, we can demonstrate it's more reliable, it's cheaper, it's in fact more efficient. And over time, will be able to undermine the large utilities.
In fact, their system is going to take forever to build out, unless, of course, they patch in their legislation. No environmental impact statements are required. It's such a great emergency that the industry, the IOUs, can do whatever they want in order to build out this grid to save humanity. That's probably going to be another one of their arguments. But still, it's going to take a huge amount of time to build out this big grid because it needs specialized labor, it needs specialized parts, it needs specialized design. It's got to go over rivers. They have to cut a huge swaths out of the forest in order to make sure that the grid doesn't start a fire or burn down in the fire. Even the labor, how do you house people? Local energy can be constructed right off the shelf by anybody, any contractor who can build a house or remodel a kitchen or even a bathroom. It's very low tech, actually, although the high tech is in manufacturing the turbines, the smaller turbines, and the panels, but that's been solved. It seems to me if we can just demonstrate in cities that it works and they're stuck in all of the problems that they're going to face with their big grid and big remote installations, it could well be that ultimately cities and counties and the people demanding the build-out of local energy. I think that's a possible scenario.
Yeah, I agree. And it doesn't require centralized control. The federal government offers tax breaks or subsidies for people to install solar panels on their homes. It would create enormous demand. And as you pointed out, ordinary building contractors can install much of that. You don't need people who are specialized in this sort of work to do it. You know, the hard work of developing cheap solar panels and windmills that are of a small enough size that they can be installed in communities has already been done. And now the cost of battery storage has come way down. So, you know, one of the big problems of, while there isn't much wind in some places or it isn't sunny all the time, it can be dealt with by installing batteries.
The struggle is going on all over the country. The investor-owned utilities are attempting to stop local energy. They've really succeeded in Oregon, much less in Washington, and that is the utilities have succeeded in Oregon. They really are powerful in the Portland City Council. They donate a lot of money. There was a feed-in tariff that they failed in their complacency to stop when it was enacted about 15 years ago. That is, people could put solar panels on their home and sell the excess energy that they didn't use at a decent price to the utilities. And they stopped it. They just legislated it. They made themselves the gatekeeper for all of that. And as a gatekeeper, they closed the gate. And nobody's been able to open that gate for local energy. It's really a scandal. Oregon is not a green state, almost in any way, not even in timbering. It's way behind California in saving its forests and destroying rural communities because they're milling the stuff elsewhere and lumbering is all mechanical. Richard Lachman, every state, and including now in Oregon, the forces of community energy are strengthening.
I think we can take heart from the successes of opposition to pipelines and see that as a model for our strategy, that we organize locally. We try to be as practical as we can to find weak points in the opposition and to hold up a model of, you know, different ways to create the energy that we need to live. And just as we can defeat pipelines and fracking, similarly, we can attack the for-profit utilities and, you know, create models of much more efficient, locally based green energy.
It's happening in Oregon now. The forces for clean local energy have organized and revived. One victory was in Portland, where the Portland Clean Energy Fund was created through an initiative, not through the city council. They would never have done it. Through an initiative that imposed taxes on the biggest companies in Oregon to build out local supplies of energy. Just as important, very recently a Clean Energy Alliance is formed. Its website is OregonCleanEnergy.org. And it's now pushing the legislature for a number of bills that would jumpstart the local community energy in this state. I think there are possibilities all over the country, and more people will begin to realize that from on the ground successes that we can, in fact, stop climate change. Richard Lachman, thanks a lot for talking to us.
It was a pleasure, Bill. Thanks so much.
That was Bill Resnick speaking with Richard Lachman about ways to save the planet by hastening our transition to renewable energy systems. Next up, movie mole Jan Hocken speaks with psychologist Emmeline Friedman about the 2020 documentary, The Social Dilemma. The film, directed by Jeff Orlowski, tells the story of the manipulative forces behind social media and how they are rewiring the human brain. Friedman is a critical psychologist and author of Internet Addiction, A Critical Psychology of Users, a book that looks at the concept of internet addiction in the context of late capitalism.
Welcome to KABU, Emmeline Friedman.
Thank you for having me.
There's been a longstanding debate among social theorists over how technology shapes mental and social life, and even modify human nature itself. Your own research, including your new book on the concept of internet addiction, takes up some of these very debates. Social anxieties over the transformative power of digital technologies take center stage in the Social Dilemma, new documentary film directed by Jeff Orlowski. So, Emmeline Friedman, it's great to have you here to help us unpack this film. How would you describe the documentary's framing of the dilemma that it takes up and attempts to explain?
Yeah, so the framing of the problem is kind of at question itself in the documentary, as you see this cast of obvious experts in the field kind of struggle and really grapple with how they would describe the dilemma. So you see these,
and they have a certain authority as both former insiders who are now outsiders who've been through this, and it grants them a particular expertise.
Certainly.
Or authority.
Yeah. So you have these insiders who are basically claiming, you know, that we thought we were coming in and doing great things for the world, and now we are not so sure. So basically, we invented this thing that's kind of, it's having these damning effects on society at large, and we're really sorry, and we want to kind of figure out what it is we've done. So the dilemma is first a dilemma of these tech rock stars' sort of guilty conscience. And then secondarily, a question of the conditioning of other human beings.
So the narrative structure draws on some conventions that are familiar to us in terms of innocence lost, or the unleashing of a Frankenstein kind of horror that started out in the laboratories of science and then unleashed unanticipated effects. So we're familiar with some of these aspects of horror films, as well as the innocent scientists who then generate effects beyond their own understanding. So what is old and what is new in this particular critique and dilemma around technology?
Yeah, so as I think you kind of started to point out, this dilemma of technology as a pharmacon, right, of both poison and cure, or blessing and curse, is sort of, you know, it's embedded in this, in a Promethean myth. So it's basically as old as fire, really. But there have been particularly loud moral panics, I think, around information technologies, right, starting from literacy, even, because of the way that, you know, literacy and then the printing press sort of threatened the asymmetrical organization of power in society, right? Whereas communication technologies, where social media sort of blends information and communication technologies, tend to have more overt roots in war and in military power. So, but if you look more recently to moral panics around television, for example, what might be considered new in social media is how to understand two-way media or all-to-all media, right? And the experts point this out in the film, that what might be new here is the fact that there is a personalization involved with these technologies, where they're not only catering the information and the communications you receive to your particular history of using the application or the software, but it also just elicits your participation in a more general way, right? Like it beeps at you, whereas other tools may take a more passive relationship, may yield to human agency more readily.
In your book, you draw on this concept of the fetishizing of technology that psychoanalytic and Marxist cultural theorists draw through different theoretical routes, but enlist this term that the technology itself acquires a kind of magical powers that obscures the human relations behind it, or the process of production behind it, and it acquires a power by its object of human projections. The film takes up some of that idea, that in trying to demystify or expose the human relations behind social media. Would you make use of that concept in analyzing the film? Does the film, in that sense, fetishize the technology it attempts to demystify?
You know, it certainly seems to overstate its case at times. And I think this owes a lot to the framing, right, where the experts have to sort of rest on the fact that they really have succeeded in kind of overtaking society in a particular way. So in the film, you see dramatizations, actually, of these sort of almighty, mystifyingly powerful algorithms, right, where the mechanism is having actors come and give voice to these algorithms that are saying, oh, you know what will really make Jimmy pay attention? You know, we'll show him these images of military power overseas, or we'll rustle his feathers by showing him images of his crush dating another boy or something like that. So you really see these algorithms as these sort of cunning agents that know you better than you know yourself in a lot of ways. You know, and this is
and
a notion that
anthropomorphizes in a very concrete way these algorithms, these networks of massive computers hooked up with each other. So what's problematic about that, would you say? That because humans do tend to personify or anthropomorphize to understand processes that are very abstract and difficult to access. So what's problematic about that?
Yeah, I guess what's a little strange in it to me, well, there are two things. The first is that it sort of passes the buck, in my opinion, right? Like there's this assumption amongst the experts who have the most knowledge about how these technologies actually function, that the algorithms sort of have a mind of their own, right? And certainly if they're being presented as other people with intentions and sort of with their own agency, it bolsters this idea that in fact, these algorithms maybe do have their own intentions and they're all powerful. When in fact, any of the folks talking about this should know, right, that it is very much a question of human and of social decision making, right, to simply pull the plug on these algorithms. So there is a passage of responsibility there. And then another thing that's strange is that, you know, the human, the user, as it's typically called in tech circles, becomes so passive and so very reduced to, you know, kind of a lifeless consumer animated by these targeted ploys to, you know, to rouse them. And so to see more personification of a computer system than of the sort of average everyday user is also another striking part of the film.
And this takes us into the mental health claims in the film and the use of the addiction model as part of that moral panic. And that's been around a long time. I remember the 80s as a psychologist being on panels to speak about parental worry and concern about kids becoming zombified by video games, and citing literature that actually kids who use these video games are not more violent than others, that that there is not a direct causal relationship between these technologies and social behavior, and that there is a lot in human experience and in developmental processes that push backs on that, that kids will, as Mark said, are both made by their history and technologies, and also remake them or use them for their own purposes. So, right. How would you what would you say about the mental health claims that are really at the center of the urgency conveyed in this film?
Yeah, well, I'll just comment first and say that you're so right to point out the, that all these moral panics sort of issue from humans' power to affect humans, right? where we create something and then it recursively molds us and then we build another thing and it happens again.
And often the anxiety centers on youth. There's a long history. And here too, it's about teenagers who escape the control of their parents and
right.
become secret addicts to these and victims of these technologies. And so there's a very much a response to middle class, particularly middle class anxieties about kids, youth coming under these malevolent forces beyond their control.
Yeah, yeah. So to your question about the mental health claims made in the film, in researching this book on internet addiction, what really hit me on the head was that there has essentially been no psychological research, in my opinion, that has successfully operationalized a notion of social media or algorithms or the internet itself, right? So there's this sort of endemic issue where, not only is it incredibly difficult to conceptualize these wieldy social, these notions for the purpose of studying them. But then there's also the problem of not really having a control group of participants who haven't been touched in some way by social media and by digital technologies, right?
So it's a global addiction they're diagnosing.
Right. So you'd think that if you can't find individuals who haven't been touched by digital technologies, then you would, stop trying to answer the problem in a way that, that targets examples of excess at the individual level. But, to answer this, these studies tend to look at the measure of time spent on social media. And the film does this too, right? It's a question of how much time you spend in front of a screen. But the problem with that being that, the way that time is actually spent on these platforms is never qualified, right? So the claims can only sort of make a point about what isn't happening, when one is on the screen.
In your book, you pursue this line of argument in the context of advanced capitalism and how value is measured in terms of time that departs from useful activity, productive activity. And there seems to be that premise underlying the film itself, just anything that people are doing that departs from their productivity. And yet paradoxically, so much of current productivity is through the internet. So it's kind of a strange claim. This one designer confesses that he's addicted to his internet. I thought that was quite laughable.
Yeah.
So it's like a writer is addicted to their typewriter. But.
Right, right. So looking at the recommendations toward the end of the film, I'm looking at some of these. They're like, don't let children really use and explore computers until they're in high school. Avoid this amount of time spent. And I keep thinking about them. And if my parents, right, I'm a sort of mid-age millennial. If my folks had taken those recommendations seriously, I think I would be at a serious disadvantage in the workforce today.
Okay, so there you have it. We need to reframe the social dilemma, and if nothing else, the film does provide a context for taking up the questions that it both addresses and simultaneously, I think you're saying, obscures. Thanks for being with us today, Emmeline Friedman, to talk about The Social Dilemma, the new film by Jeff Orlowski that's available on many, many platforms online.
Thank you very much, Jan. It's great to be here.
That was Jan Hocken and Emmeline Friedman about the pernicious effects of social media. Black History Month became an official celebration in this country in 1976. It has been a repeated reminder, if not fully adequate, of the contributions and achievements of African Americans in the U.S. But is there a downside to this annual celebration? That's what Sharon Grant explores in her commentary on the commercialization of Black History Month. She reads excerpts from an article published this February in The Guardian by African-American attorney and writer Malaika Jabali.
This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I have watched very little commercial TV the last 2 years or so, as I don't have a television and don't want to. But during the pandemic, I've taken to having staycations around town just to be out of my living space for a day and, yes, watch a little TV. I have been struck by the number of Black faces I've seen on TV, which is new to us all, and especially during this Black History Month. We appear to be everywhere, selling everything, in the backdrop of being disproportionately unemployed, unhoused, and dying of COVID-19. I mentioned this on several occasions to a friend who sent me an article I will read titled, "A Corporate Commodified Black History Month is Taking Hold. We Can't Let It," by Malaika Jabali, printed in the February 23, 2021 issue of The Guardian. Jabali is a Brooklyn-based policy attorney and writer. Here are excerpts from the article. Black History Month, the annual commemoration of Black history in the United States that originated with Carter G. Woodson's Negro History Week, is winding down. I have to admit, this year's celebration is among the worst yet. Instead of providing a platform to explore the rich history of Black people in America, this month has been a billboard for commodified representations of Blackness. Commercializing holidays and co-opting Black culture are both standard practices in America, like the pat Black Lives Matter virtue signaling last June. Branded co-optation of Black history has been rampant. For some, this visibility may indicate that Black people have advanced. But what I see is an admission. Powerful elected officials and corporations in the United States resort to symbolism and token opportunities because they'd rather not offer anything else. In a system that relies on exploiting labor and directing resources to an elite minority, actually advancing the health and prosperity of the masses of Black people undermines the exploitation that capitalism relies on. Right-wingers crystallized this point in the early months of the pandemic. We can't let the stock market tank, so we have to get people back into stores and warehouses to service us. To put a finer point on it, conservatives on both sides of the aisle assume that if these workers, who are disproportionately Black and brown, are given any sort of government aid or regular stimulus checks, they may not want to slave away in low-wage jobs. God forbid, people can protect their well-being and not stuff some corporate manager's pockets. So instead of transformative policy, a select few Black Americans are given hyper-visibility. Instead of living wages, universal health care, student debt cancellation, free public college, or anything that can minimize the massive Black-white wealth gap, we get Black History Month-themed Apple Watches and Black sitcom collections on Netflix. Instead of reparations to address the centuries of harm that contributed to Black Americans facing some of the highest COVID-related fatalities, we get kente cloth prayers. Instead of commitments to defund police departments or good faith debates around abolition amid perhaps the largest protest movement in history, we get the author of the crime bill for president, who made some unbinding commitments to include a few Black people in his administration. What we don't get, however, is progress. After decades of a political realignment that saw Democrats focus policy on business interests and pivot marketing to Black Americans, the Black incarceration rate has grown, Black unemployment has grown, the Black-white wealth gap has grown, and the Black homeownership rate has been virtually unchanged since the 1970s. The percentage of Black men without a job in deindustrialized towns has reached up to 53% for Black men in their prime working years in a city like Milwaukee, while Black women and Latinas experienced the largest job losses of any other demographic by 2020's end. In 2021, with the financial security of many Black people bottoming out, historical firsts are not enough, and parading Black people on screen is not progress. Adequate depictions of Black people in media and politics are important. Not seeing the complicity of Black people in media or in literature is alienating. When the movement for civil rights transitioned into more discreet calls for Black political power in the late 60s and 70s, Black people were practically invisible among the country's mayoralties. But after 50 years of Black Americans ticking off firsts in myriad categories, what good does it serve if the communities that elected them are in the same condition they were in the 60s? What good is it to have dozens of commercials depicting Black families and business owners on screen if most Black families in our real lives can't enjoy the security of home ownership and many struggle to retain employment? Representation means something. It means someone works on behalf of someone other than themselves. The mere existence of a Black person in entertainment, a boardroom, or in much-needed political positions is not representation. That is one half of the equation. Individual achievements are not representation. Hypervisibility is not representation. When the 1970s saw the first round of Black mayors in cities like Atlanta, Detroit, and Los Angeles, these historical firsts were a proxy for communal uplift. I was a beneficiary of that movement, with my family moving to Georgia right as Atlanta's first Black mayor served another term. As a child, I witnessed Black people lead in every level of government, countering the myths of white supremacy that for generations insisted we barely even had human rights. But in 2021, with the financial security of many Black people bottoming out, historical firsts are not enough. And parading Black people on screen is not progress. Token leaders with token gains, as Malcolm X stated, are not sufficient. There's a particular cruelty, especially now, in pretending that they are. This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mo Variety Hour, reading the article, "A Corporate Commodified Black History Month is Taking Hold. We Can't Let It," by Malaika Jabali.
Thank you, Sharon Grant. For those who would like to read the full text of Jabali's article, you can find a link to it on our KBOO webpage. We now turn to a new documentary called BAM, The Black Arts Movement, which was written and co-produced by two professors of English at Washington State University, Tabiti Lewis and Pavithra Narayanan. Dr. Lewis is interviewed here by Mole Julian Ankney from the Nemipu or Nez Perce Reservation in Idaho.
BAM, Chicago's Black Arts Movement film, co-directed and produced by Tabiti Lewis, professor of English and associate vice chancellor of academic affairs at Washington State University, Vancouver. He teaches contemporary American literature, specializing in multicultural and Black American literature. And Pavithra Narayanan, academic director, Colleges of Arts and Sciences at Washington State University, Vancouver, introduces viewers to dozens of writers, artists, musicians, community organizers, organizations, and institutions, among others. Was inspired by a book. Can you tell us about that?
The film project is the outgrowth of a book project with Northwestern University Press of the same name, Chicago's Black Arts Movement. The book examines Chicago as a cityscape during the Black Arts Movement in the 1960s and 70s and early 80s, and examines why Chicago not only had a thriving Black arts moment, but why it existed beyond what other moments of the Black arts movement in other cities was able to. And one of the reasons behind that is this focus in Chicago on building organizations and activism, which is in the DNA, but also an impetus of understanding the importance of community building institutions So you had the first African-American museum, which was the DuSable Museum that was started by Margaret Burroughs, who visual artists coming out of the 1940s. You had the foundation of people like Richard Wright and others in the Southside Community Arts Center that really provided a foundational dynamic strength for this next generation of artists of the 1960s to stand upon. And while the Black Arts Movement emerged in New York in 1965, and one of the major figures was Amiri Baraka, there's no question that the Midwestern cities such as Detroit, Chicago, St. Louis, Southern cities such as New Orleans, Atlanta, the West Coast, the LAs and the Oaklands also took on their own energy and iteration of it. And so I approached Northwestern University Press to say, this would be a great project. No one has done this. There are books looking at Chicago and the Negro Renaissance, if you quote Negro Renaissance. And I said, there should be a book that just focuses on Chicago and the Black Arts Movement and the unique nature of that. And they thought it was a good idea. And so, one of the components of this project is that I've compiled about 8 or 9 interviews with people such as Phil Coran, Hakeem Adabudi, Angela Jackson, Usini Perkins, Eugene Redmond, Val Gray Ward, Carol Parks. And so knowing that I was going to have these interviews as part of the project, I said to Pavithra, look, I have to interview these people. We should really take advantage of this task, this project, and I'd like you to help me make a film. And so she agreed, and we wrote a grant, small grant, didn't even get as much as we should have. Thank you from the university, but we should have gotten more. And we put a lot of grit and sweat into putting this thing together. And so then as we made the film, invited her to join as a co-editor for the project. So the book is the impetus for the film, and the film comes about because of an opportunity that the book created. And my ultimate idea was for the two to work together, for the film to be a compendium of the book. So now we need the book. And so that's what we're wrapping up right now.
At the impetus of this, could you have ever imagined that you would be producing a film on the Black Arts Movement now after meeting all these inspiring figures? And how have they impacted your work?
When I was, in my early 20s, I seized upon opportunity to participate in an internship at the World Press. And it went so well that the publisher, Hakeem Adabudi, said, look, you should come back and work with us. We would really love to have you here. We could use you. And I said, I have to go to graduate school, but I'll be back. Now, I studied English and I majored in history. I majored in English because I was drawn to it and knew that this is something I wanted to do when in my introduction to African-American literature course that was taught by this phenomenal historian who was a fellow at the University of Rochester, but she's so thorough that she also was teaching African-American literature because she was working on a project around Zora Neale Hurston. So although she's a historian, she's really studying Black women writers. And so I was blown away when I encountered the Black Arts Movement section in our class, and I found my home. And I said, this is incredible. I love the fact that they are engaging in self-determination and defining their own aesthetics and voice for themselves and resisting history and oppression of America. And the audience for these writers is not white folk or trying to appease liberals, but literally speaking to Black people, speaking out against racism and oppression and not caring whether people are offended or not, just speaking their truth, the truth. And so when I went to Chicago, I had an opportunity to work at the press and be part of organizing and helping with Black writers' conferences that were taking place. And mind you, those weren't the first Black writers' conferences, but I didn't know that then. Alice Brown had been doing this during the Black Arts Movement. But at that time, I'm just thinking, hey, the World Press, and, I'm meeting Gwendolyn Brooks and Amiri Baraka and Sonia Sanchez, and all of these writers are coming through. and I'm working at the press, and every day I'm working on manuscripts in the 1990s, new books that we're working on, but also having an opportunity to interact with some of these different writers. And so I knew that this is something great and special. And so I didn't know when, but that it was necessary, which is why when I took on Tony K. Bambara, topic for my dissertation and then later two books, she comes right out of the Black Arts Movement. The opportunity presented itself and I had an idea, but I didn't really know what would be the manifestation of that, and certainly not a film. And the book itself will be one that not only teaches people about the Black Arts Movement in general, but the specific nature and importance of Chicago during this time. And Midwest in America and Black activism in the 60s and 70s was really had a unique impact because for so many different reasons. Economy shifts that just produced the dynamics in the middle of America that was different from what was happening on the coast. And so it was no longer just thinking about Harlem or, you know, spaces like Harlem or Newark from St. Louis. And as a kid, I didn't know it all, but the arts that I was being introduced to was a bag. There was a in Forest Park, which is bigger than Central Park in New York. On the weekends, you had what they call a place called Hippie Hill. And you had the different jazz artists, et cetera, that would, and they called it Hippie Hill because Dad told me that's where the hippies, you know, would go in the 70s and, you know, smoke weed and hang out. And so you had this sort of multicultural space in a very segregated city, unaware of the fact that you're really around this kind of stuff. And then going to Chicago and being at Third World Press was absolutely, for me, an extension. I gone from reading about these writers to meeting them and learning so much that I didn't know. I was just interested in the writers and got an introduction to community activists and historians and Black study scholars and, you know, people running theaters and Montu dance and the dancers and AACM. And so, man, it was just incredible. When I was there, the On the Beach stuff was long gone, but, you know, that was the vibrancy and the dynamics, you know, of the city.
Wow, that's amazing. How hard was it for you to actually narrow down the hours and hours of interview footage that you got? I can't even imagine how hard that undertaking must have been.
Yeah, you have to make a film to appreciate not bothering the editors and the production people about what to put in, because it's a lot of work. And, you know, if it were up to me, as Pavithra always will say, the film would be 6 hours long, right?
Yes.
And I'm right. I say I'm right because everyone is important. All those voices are important. There's so much that people need to know. And I still would like to make the film another 10 or 15 minutes longer. The only thing that stops the artist in creating the product is, for me anyway, is knowing that we have the book, which has the full interviews with everyone. And the introduction to the book is about 40 pages long, where I'm sort of laying out this whole trajectory. And so you're saying to yourself, okay, the whole story is told, the you know, the pieces on each, okay, there's something on Southside Community Arts Center, check. Black Writers Conference, Alice Brown, check. IEPE, check. Path Press, as well as Third World Press, and check, check, ETA, check. So then you just sort of say, okay, you can actually, in that print version, make sure that all these things are covered. Okay.
You said that through the literary journal Black World, who published inspiring new Black literary artists who were at the forefront pretty much of Black publishing. If you had to choose three people, and three people only, who would be your absolute favorite poet or artist?
Can't limit it. And I'm going to give you a small list. And Tony K. Bambara, because I think she's an amazing short story writer and really smart. Ralph Ellison, as far as I'm concerned, written one of the greatest books of all time, and certainly in American literature. Ishmael Reed, one of the smartest and fastest thinking people that I've really ever encountered. When you look at the writers like Colson Whitehead and these other people, Ishmael hitting you with a million ideas a minute. Gwen Brooks is bar none, one of the most wonderful poets that there is. And Lorraine Hansberry, I'm just going to say Chicago, but she's just an amazing, amazing, brilliant playwright. So Raisin in the Sun is an American classic. And then, of course, I'm going to talk about film, August Wilson, who has 10 plays. The man's brilliant. So I gave you 6. You asked for 3.
Yes, thank you so much. Katsiao Yao, thank you again to BD for producing BAM, Chicago's Black Arts Movement film, and for talking with us here, your loyal fans at KBOO Radio, Katsiao Yao, and Kulawit. Good evening.
Thank you for having me.
That was a clip from the new Frankie Foam Blues by Philip Cochran and the Artistic Heritage Ensemble. Before that, we heard Julian Ankeny speaking with Tabiti Lewis about the Black Arts Movement. For further information about the film, listeners can email Dr. Lewis directly at thabiti@wsu.edu. Later today, we'll post a longer version of the interview on our KBOO webpage, in which Dr. Lewis discusses jazz and poetry in the Black Arts Movement. That concludes our show for this morning. I'd like to thank MOLE's Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, Sharon Grant, and Julian Ankeny for their contributions. Thank you also to their guests, Richard Lockman, Emmeline Friedman, and Tabiti Lewis. A huge thank you to hardworking KBOO staff who keep the station on the air, and thanks to you, our listeners, for your generous and ongoing support. As one last salute to Black History Month, we're going to leave our listeners with the song, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. This moving rendition is sung by Odetta.
Sometimes